The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
What's your deal, Cooper?
What do you mean?
You got a fiery side?
I can kiss you.
Oh, well, I would accept that with an open mouth.
Why is that so hard to believe?
Because you look like a flute player in a wedding band. That's fucking why.
What a stupid toast. You're delightful.
As are you.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I'm Aislinn Addington.
And I am Tobin Addington. And with us today, I'm so excited. We have one of my favorite people in the world. This is Avery Stork. Avery, Hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Tell the nice people at home who you are and what you do.
Yes. Well, I am the chair of the dramatic writing department at Savannah College of Art and Design. So I teach all kinds of script writing, screenwriting, TV writing, playwriting, and I have a great faculty. And I know Tobin and Aislinn back when we were in film school. So it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
It's been a while, but Avery is an Addington favorite.
I want to stay an Addington favorite, so I can keep on getting those candy wreaths at Christmas. Just
there you go. The secret's out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's probably no surprise that she likes our parents more than us. Avery would come out to Montana when we were in film school together, and I'd be shooting in Montana, and she would always jump at the chance to come out to Montana and help with movies. And so she's been adopted. She is officially adopted Addington.
My husband and I would, you guys know Dave. He and I still talk about our dream is to move to Montana. We constantly dream about it. We think that is the most beautiful place in the world, and we're always talking about, you know, one of these days. It's been 10 years now.
There's still time.
Well, we will welcome you as always with open arms whenever you are ready to come. Aislinn, what movie are we talking about today?
Today we are talking about the movie Spy from 2015.
Aislinn, when did you first see the movie?
I saw the movie in the theater. I was excited to see Melissa McCarthy be an action hero. Mm-hmm. I've been a fan of hers way back from Gilmore Girls. And so I was, you know, so excited with her sort of career taking off in a different, you know, on a different trajectory from Bridesmaids, which I know is a lot of people's mm-hmm. kind of in with her. And so I thought, yes, of course, I want to see her be a spy. And as we'll get into when we talk about the movie, I was not entirely prepared. You know, it's a farce, but it's also a violent spy movie,
an action movie, right? And
this has happened to me on multiple occasions, going in kind of completely unaware of the things that I would choose not to see if I could. You know, then I was just sort of there and like, okay, this is happening.
You're talking about the breaking of the ankle scene was probably one of those.
Any number of, yes, or the...
On the roof. That always makes me cringe.
That is terrible. Yeah. And the stabbing and subsequent vomiting.
Oh yes. And the throat yes. disintegration.
Oh, gosh. Oh, with Zach Woods. Yeah. Anyway, Zach sorry. Said, too much, oh, too no. much. So I saw in the theater with a couple of friends. I think I liked it the best out of the three of us. And then I hadn't seen it since. You know, it was one that I really enjoyed, but it wasn't a purchaser for me. I think because of some of those notes that... that Avery and I just ran through. Avery, how about you? When did you first see it?
I saw it probably, I didn't see it in the theater. I'm a big Melissa McCarthy fan and a big Paul, is it Feig?
Yeah.
Feig fan. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, one of these things where I just never got to the theater, but I saw it on, I don't know, cable or on demand or whatever. And I it's one of those movies that if it's on, I'll always watch. And sometimes I'll just pull it up if it's, you know, if it's playing. I loved it. And I also really liked, I liked the comedy aspect. I'm a big sort of comedy person. My husband and I, have done a lot of improv comedy since our days in New York, and we still do it here in Savannah. So seeing actors, and I know that Paul Feig uses, you know, he writes the script. He has the actors do the script as written, and then he'll have them riff and he'll have them improvise a lot. And in fact, I read this interesting article about one of the editors, Brett White, who is sort of known for editing improv scenes. So I was always really fascinated to see how all these things come together. So I saw it, and I, like Aislinn, was not expecting it to be kind of as dark as it was. But then after Bridesmaids and the whole, like, say, they sort of went there in Bridesmaids, you know, in the, the sink scene.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, you know, I sort of knew. I loved it. I thought it was funny. I think Melissa McCarthy is just, she's just so charming and wonderful. So I've been a fan of it since I first saw it.
Thanks. How about you, Tobin?
That's awesome. Like Avery, I didn't see it in the theater. So I sort of knew, I'd heard that it was as much an action movie, or was described to me as being as much an action movie as it was a comedy. And so I was sort of prepared for that. Maybe Aislinn, it was probably you who first told me that. I was like, this is great, but I don't know that I can watch it again anytime soon. So I didn't see it until it was on DVD and just fell head over heels for it. And I've seen it a few times since. I actually taught it last spring in an intro to film class. We were doing a unit on a genre unit. We watched The Bourne Ultimatum and Spy were our two. It was really, we had a very, very, very good discussion after Spy with I'm sure a lot of things we'll talk about today. But yeah, I've always enjoyed this movie.
Actually, Tobin, you're the one who first said, you got to watch The Bourne Ultimatum. It's such a good movie. And I was like, oh, I'm not really an action, you know, and I loved it. It's such a good movie. So you turned me on to that.
I remember one night you guys were over for dinner, and I tried to send you home with the DVD just to like, just keep it as long as you want. Just watch these movies at some point. You're like, no, I just never will. I thought, oh, okay.
I did. Wait, was it the first, what's the first one? The Bourne
Identity.
Oh, that's the one you told me to watch.
Well, because it was and the first one. Yeah.
I have since watched it. And then it's one of those movies Dave will watch whenever it's on. That one, Die Hard, and The Hunt for Red October.
I love Dave so much.
I know. It just reminded me of how much it's fun to all hang out together.
Yeah.
I do like spy movies.
Oh, right. Hey, Tobin.
Hey, Aislinn.
Could you give us your two bits, your film history for this piece?
Yeah, two little bits of trivia here. The first is that this movie wasn't originally written for Melissa McCarthy. He was writing it not necessarily, apparently, with anybody in mind. And it wasn't till, as the story goes, she was over for dinner at his house and was sort of asking what he was doing next. And he described it. And they both apparently sort of had the idea kind of simultaneously, like, oh my God, you'd be perfect for this. And I think it shows in the movie that it's a different kind of McCarthy character than their previous two collaborations in The Heat or Bridesmaids. So I'm anxious to talk about that. And the other thing he writes the script, as Avery was saying, and then there's these great improv scenes. He'll set up two cameras on characters when they're talking to one another, which is an unusual thing to do in a movie of this size, and so that he can catch their reactions in real time as they're reacting to each other's improvisations. And he has a team of writers sort of cycling through who are writing what they call alts, alternate lines, that they'll write on post-it notes and hand to him, and he will read them and give some of them to the actors in the middle of the scene, and they'll have them sort of take that note and try that line and try that joke. So it's kind of an unusual way to sort of make a movie, but my God, when it works so, so well.
And I know that Judd Apatow works in a very similar way, where he'll have a script, and then he'll just trust his ensemble players to sort of riff. I don't know if he actually feeds them lines, but I know that he, you know, depends on his actors a lot to bring it to the next level. And I love that sort of freedom. And then the article I was reading about the editor, how the editors tighten everything up, tighten up all the jokes. So it's a really fun it's a fun and sort of interactive way to work. And when I work with where I teach, that we have a live multicam sitcom that we produce every quarter.
Oh, cool.
And we use alts. Like, we write the script. My students write the script in the writer's room. And then one of the things we do is we write a whole bunch of different alts, which is something, you know, that does happen, but it's the actors now are so used to the idea of let's try this alt, let's try this alt. It's really kind of freeing for the actors. That's what they tell us anyway.
Very cool. I know that on Parks and Rec with Michael Shore, they did that as well. They would do a fun through.
I love that.
At least somewhat actor generated versus handing the sticky notes over, like I know Paula Pell and Tina Fey do. But that's where some of they'll say I've heard Amy Poehler say some of her favorite things that happen in that piece, and then like the editors get to weave it together with what the kind of original intent was with those extra little sprinkles on top. So creativity.
Aislinn, why don't you take us through the list of the ladies in charge, women involved in major roles in Spy?
I would love to. In major roles, we have Melissa McCarthy, Rose Byrne, and Allison Janney. Producers include Michelle Colombo, Jesse Henderson, and Jeno Topping. And then editor, Melissa Bretherton. And so this is a departure for us in that it was neither written nor directed by a woman?
Yes. I can't remember if this is the first time. It may be the first time we're doing one of those on this show. Yeah.
It might be. Certainly the first time it's been one dude who wrote and directed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In this case, though, because someone asked me about it earlier, because people want to know what we're doing. all right, come on now. And I thought, oh yeah, that feels different for us. However, I think it being Paul Feig who helmed the women reboot of Ghostbusters, mm-hmm. and was involved in Bridesmaids, right? Directed Bridesmaids?
He directed it. Yeah.
It was written by Kristen Wiig and
Annie.
Amy?
Annie.
Mulula.
Yeah.
Mulula.
So
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, and he directed The Heat, which I also really liked, but that was also, that was written by Katie Diepold. So I think it's strange. I was like, oh, I thought a woman wrote this, but he seems to lead. He seems to, listen to a lot of different female voices in his world. So I think that's
right.
Sort of
absolutely. Yeah. I think he appreciates strong and creative women, and he might be the one holding the spotlight in this case, but the spotlight is certainly on Melissa and the other, female players in the piece. Mm-hmm. So, Tobin, would you give us a brief plot description?
Sure. Here's what I could make of Spy. Melissa McCarthy plays Susan Cooper, a desk-bound CIA analyst who goes undercover to infiltrate the world of a deadly arms dealer played by Rose Byrne and prevent a global catastrophe. All because Jude Law's Bradley Fine, a conceited James Bond doppelganger, gets himself killed in the line of duty. Susan must overcome assassins, bombs, poisonings, awful aliases provided by the agency, her own insecurities, a ridiculous Jason Statham caricature played by Jason Statham, and a very handsy Italian or maybe British operative to foil the master plan.
Love it.
That's a great, yes.
I have another quick edit.
Yes.
I would love us to include Miranda Hart in.
Oh yes, sure.
The women involved as a.
Oh, that's a good point.
Actress,
yeah.
And writer, who doesn't steal the show, because I don't think you can steal a show from Melissa McCarthy, but certainly comes up to her level in it.
Yeah, she's really fun in it. Yeah.
So, thank you. All right, so now we have the plot outline. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
We can get into it. Yeah, we you know, meet Susan Cooper in the rodent infested basement of the CIA. And we see a number of women in there. Mm-hmm. That Miranda Hart is there. Jessica Chaffin, who I love, is also, maybe can we ding for Jessica Chaffin real quick?
And I think Katie did pull yes. plays someone there too, right? She's one
She's blonde. And at one point there's a, or no, maybe she's not the one. Yeah. I think she spits the cake out. Isn't that her?
Oh, is that her? Okay.
And then the other one's Jessica Chaffin.
Yeah.
There's one woman, poor woman, who has a mouse or a rat on her breast.
Yeah, that's one of those Chaffin. Two. Yeah, okay, there you go. That's it.
Yes, yeah. You know what's interesting about that? When I was rewatching it for this, I realized that when Melissa McCarthy, when Susan Cooper is looking at the screen and trying to help Jude Law's character through, what she's seeing almost looks like a maze, like a rat's maze. Mm. You know, she's seeing the people. Yeah. Kind of, and then there's, you know, these bats that are, or rats that are around. So I don't know. I don't know if that was some sort of interesting thing, how they're all kind of stuck in this sort of maze, you know, together of intrigue. I thought that was cool.
I love it.
That's good. That's good.
That's metaphor.
I like that it starts as sort of that woman behind the man trope.
Yeah.
That then mm-hmm. quickly gets flipped over. Turned on his head and stabbed.
It's so true because I think that's a big issue that a lot of women work sort of tirelessly and do the dirty work and the grunt work and the detail work and do it for the male bosses mm-hmm. and the male bosses sort of get the glory. The other day, probably last year, in one of these writers' rooms that I was mentoring, I was giving notes to the writers. There were four writers, and only the female writer was taking notes.
Oh my god!
Wow. And by the way, the three male writers are fantastic and wonderful, but they just were listening. They were just taking it in. But the female writer was taking notes, and I stopped and I said, "I can't have the only woman in the room be the note taker to email to everyone else. You guys have to take out and take your own notes."
Seriously.
And later, they were like, "Oh, we didn't even." I feel like I've fallen into that role before. You know, I'll just do it. Mm-hmm. I'll just take the notes at the meeting. And so I really, really related to the Susan Cooper character and all these women who were being this essential backup without the glory.
The women in this movie.
Okay.
It's just true. And I think what a great opportunity you took to, call it out and name it for your students while still, you know, supporting them. Like you say, they're great people. And next time, not only will they maybe do things differently, but then it'll be their turn to disrupt something. So
that's right.
I think that's great.
Thank you.
As we learned when we talked about Zero Dark Thirty, the analysts at CIA are not unusual to have a lot of targeters and analysts be women. So this is a part that is, you know, it's a comedy and it's played for laughs, but it also there gets at something true to the way that these sort of systems work, which is something that I think Paul Feig has to be conscious of to one degree or another. A lot of the things in this movie that we kind of laugh at underneath, I think there's sort of more reality to it. And you're so right. The women in this movie are time and again the most uncomplicatedly competent people in the movie. Mm-hmm. Like there are some men in the movie who do get some things done, but they have to either, you know, like call attention to themselves or, you know, take credit for other people sort of doing the dirty work, as opposed to time and again in this movie where it's sort of refreshing to see that it's just with a noted lack of complication that these women are getting the job done.
They're just taking care of business. Even the female assassin, she's not. Just that great kitchen scene. And she's not going to, you know, walk around like Bobby Cannavale's character, who's like, let me tell you how fantastic I am, you know, which I love. Yes. It's so funny. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And I think in terms of performance, the men in it really leaned in, if you will, to those sort of tropes that they were playing with. I mean, Jude Law is so patronizing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And hopefully, I mean, the way I sort of read it, in this watch of it, they were in on the joke. I mean, that's always the thing you're concerned, right? Like, wait a second. Does Jason Statham know that this is a caricature of Jason Statham? I don't know. But
I hope so.
The other just
I actually never really liked him before, but this is the movie where I thought, oh, I thought the fact that he was able to make fun of his, you know, as Tobin put it in his summary, the Jason Statham caricature. Mm-hmm. I thought it was so fun. And Jude Law making fun of sort of his character. I thought the men sort of embrace their bumbling glory, you know, glory roles in a really fun way. So nice. I think it really worked.
Absolutely. And by the way,
what's
glory roles is my new band name.
Oh my God. I just, as I was saying it, I thought that sounds like glory hole, which I think is something dirty. I'm not sure. Actually, I do know it is dirty.
Nice try. You know exactly what it is. Nice try.
Tobin, I interrupted you.
Oh, I was going to say that the one of the points we came to in the group discussion I had with my class, you get a whole group talking about things, kind of like we do here sometimes, and you all sort of arrive at a new view of things. And one of the things that came out of that discussion was that the men in this movie, if you sort of add almost all of them together, it's sort of like they are all in a James Bond movie thinking they're James Bond. And we are seeing what the other characters, particularly the women, like what's Moneypenny's view of Bond,
right, you know? Right.
And then the Bond movies play it from Bond's point of view. And he's so sexy and so serious and so, you know, whatever, devastating. And then you see it from her point of view. It's like, get your hands off me.
Yeah.
Like, do your job.
Yeah,
you
this
know?
Is not
like,
the time.
Yeah, exactly. And it just, that was a funny thing, especially having just seen another, you know, more quote unquote serious spy movie, to sort of think that, oh, maybe this is maybe a more true to life view of, you know, the characters in those movies.
Love it.
Right. And the Aldo character is so funny and so awful and great. And then they're all so sort of bumbling in one way or the other. And, but thinking that they are the most dashing people on planet Earth.
Yeah, they're all going to save the day regardless.
You mentioned the
female assassin, and then that reminds me of the other a female operative, Marina Baccarin. Is that how we're going to say that? Okay. Who's just in it briefly. And that I wrote down, and I don't want to belabor it, but I just want to ask you all how you felt about how they dealt with something that's, you know, on the Twitter, etc. a lot recently is a discussion of thin privilege. And so I wrote down like thin privilege, beauty privilege. I certainly don't want to be the person who's adding privilege to everything. Right. I'm not trying to do that. But because it's sort of in the ether right this second anyway, I'm wondering how you think they dealt with, you know, Melissa McCarthy as a fiercely real, as Tyra Banks would say, woman, a woman shaped human, I would say.
And even Miranda, I'm sorry, what was her last name?
Miranda Hart.
Miranda Hart being tall and sort of doesn't fit into the typical, you know, I don't think it's bad to say the sort of thin privilege. I think it's a beauty privilege in a way, and it exists. It really does. People, women, men, there's studies that people get noticed and even can get opportunities based on how they look. And I think they handled it in a really, really fun way in the setup where they say, oh, we're here all, you know, they waited long for their drinks. And then her character, the Karen Walker character, gets her drink, you know, immediately. You know, things like that happen a lot. In fact, I will tell a little story that back at many, many years ago, before I met you guys, I worked at a fashion magazine in New York City, and I was, I probably shouldn't say too much about it, but I worked at a big national fashion magazine, and I was in charge of a group of fact checkers, and I was the research editor, and an editor came up to me, and I had maybe 7 fact checkers, and they were all amazing and smart and wonderful writers. But there was one young woman who was really lovely, thin, blonde. She dressed really well. And this editor came up to me out of the blue and said, hey, I want to give this writer a story. can she write? And I said, well, of course she can write. And she said, okay, good. You know, this fact checker story. And she said, she looks the part. Mm. And I thought, oh my goodness. She, first of all, this young woman was fantastic and she took the most out of this opportunity. So I would never begrudge her this opportunity, but she definitely got a story, an assignment because she looked the part that this particular editor wanted. And the editor did not approach the other fact checker. So things like that do happen. And that's why I love that they sort of tackled it in the first, 15 minutes or so.
Absolutely. I thank you for that story. Angers me as so many things do, but I'm glad that she was also talented and made the most of it, like you say. Shortly after I wrote the beauty privilege thing down, I wrote then the quote, "We need someone invisible," and so that was said shortly after, you know, in the bar she can't get the bartender's attention, it's so true. That we, you know, we see or we spend energy seeing some people and not others. And whether that's because of, appearance in one way or another, there's certainly many reasons for it, but, they're sort of using that in this space. Tobin, I didn't let you answer.
The perfect agent. Yeah.
What did you think of how they handled, those ideas?
I think that I think this is one of the places where it shows that the movie wasn't written for Melissa McCarthy, that it feels like there's that great scene where Allison Janney shows the video of Melissa McCarthy when she was in training. Mm-hmm.
You are top of your class at the Academy in all computer and support skills. No surprise there. But you have a certain tame demeanor around the office that says you've never even held a gun. So imagine my surprise when I saw footage from this drill back at the farm.
Sam, I can't even. Is that me? I can't really.
Stupid gun! Yeah!
Somebody definitely sped this up. Camera angles and stuff make. Okay.
Ouch.
Out of context, that's,
I must have watched this 15 times now because what the fuck?
Well, I
almost put it up on YouTube.
You see how incredible, what an incredible field agent she, could have been in training. And then we learn from Allison Janney that she suspects that the Jude Law character was intimidated by that.
Yeah, and, sniped her.
Killed her career. Sniped her career. Which ties all of this stuff kind of together, I think, because in another movie, I think the fact that Melissa McCarthy does not look like a traditional female spy character in terms of her sort of body type, that would be the joke of that video,
right.
But it's not. The joke of that video is, holy cow, she was really good. What happened? Why isn't she in this role? Oh, it's because this guy was a douchebag.
Right.
And I think that because of the emphasis there, it makes the joke isn't about her. Mm-hmm. The joke is about, oh my, there's truth under the joke.
Right.
You know what I mean? About why it happened.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I was worried about that when I first was about to go see the movie, because I had been frankly disappointed. Like I said, I'd enjoyed Melissa McCarthy on Gilmore Girls, where the jokes were never about her size or shape. They just weren't. She was an amazing chef. She was quirky. She was clumsy, but that was it. And then in Bridesmaid, she's a real character. She's sort of a weirdo, if you will, as someone who loves weirdos, but it also wasn't about that. And then shortly after that, she hosted Saturday Night Live for the first time, and everything I saw her do was, fat lady falls down the stairs, fat lady eats a lot of ranch dressing. Like, it was just, it was so one note to me, knowing what she can do. And I don't know the background and how she felt about any of those things, because she does embrace, odd characters. She loves a wig. I mean, we've heard her talk about on shows. She loves a crazy wig. She loves, a pleated pant. Like, she loves to push the envelope that way. But I just felt like, oh gosh, why, if this is the first time someone saw her and you know, and we all know people who love SNL, and you know,
she's so much more than a fat joke.
Yeah,
she's so much.
So I was worried. Yeah. I was a little bit concerned when I first went into this, and then, like you say, Tobin, the point of showing her physicality was to demonstrate how talented she was.
Right.
At that job.
And I agree. That was such a fun, the plot did not belabor. Like there wasn't a whole arc of, oh, she's learning how to handle a gun. She's learning. Right. She's just really, she's an amazing field agent, which also goes to the fact that, you know, Tobin, when you had said that the Jude Law character kind of was intimidated by her and kind of talked her into being the voice in his ear. I think that's part of it. But I also think, because Allison Janney says something like, that sniping thing that she's like, a lot of male agents did that, and that stopped when I took the job here. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's male agents using a really great resource because they want to benefit from it. But I also think that Melissa McCarthy her character suffered from a lack of, I would say it's not really insecurity. She knew her worth. She knew she was good. She just didn't know her worth. You know, she was tentative. She didn't. There's definitely an emotional arc where she finally sort of grows into the fact that she's a badass, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that Jude Law was able to. The reason I don't think she ever fulfilled that potential is because she never truly, I don't know, felt confident or believed in herself. And I had mixed feelings about that because. I think that's very true. As women, we tend to sometimes we'll be really accomplished, but just not believe in ourselves. And then I wasn't sure if that was something that rang true to other people, you know, that her sort of insecure to secure arc. Did you all like that?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I also have written down from early on that Susan quotes her mother as saying things like, just blend in, let someone else win, which, I mean, happened to not be anything I ever heard as a child, so I'm grateful for that. but so I think that speaks to a like you say, maybe knowing your worth but not sharing it. You know, right. Don't draw attention to yourself for whatever reason. I think that's something that people hear, certainly from others, and I would venture to say that women maybe traditionally have heard it more than men.
For
but
sure.
I love that idea of like you say, of her learning to own her badassness, because it has been in there the whole time.
Is it badassery or badassness?
Ooh, I like badassery. Ooh. Thank you for that.
Badassery. Let's go with that.
I like that. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And I want
to also talk.
Oh, go ahead.
No, yep. No, no. Go for it.
I was going to move us forward just a little bit and say, I think for me, one of the first real time she demonstrates that path into the full fledged badassery is when she shrugs off the second frumpy persona. Because she's the first one, I forget, you know. But was frumpy number one, and then frumpy number two was a crazy cat lady, and that's when she goes to the store and you know gets her whole self done to look a little bit more like that kind of spy dressed up at a gala, which then immediately Rose Byrne is so super critical of.
Which is, I think,
funny in a different way. I find Rose Byrne had to work so hard for me to find her charming, just in general. Mm-hmm. I was set up to not care about the Rose Byrne. And
you mean in this movie in particular,
no,
or Rose Byrne is an actress?
Just in general.
Okay. That's what I thought you were saying.
Not my, you know, why do I need this another, you know, beautiful, tiny, you know, good actress. Why do I need her? Tell me why I need her. And she was so good at being the worst in Bridesmaids. I mean, she's set up to be, that girl at the party everyone rolls their eyes at. But she just, I think, embraced it so much. And then I'm a huge fan of the film Adult Beginners. I don't know if anybody's seen it. It's Nick Kroll wrote it. And it's not his usual thing. It's very heartfelt and And, you know, I would say it's a drama with some comedy in it. And it's another one where she and Bobby Cannavale are, you know, act together as they like to mm-hmm. do. The world's most beautiful couple.
Yes.
But anyway, so I've really grown to appreciate her so much. And so, you know, in Bridesmaids, she was the straight woman, if you will. But weren't they all? And then in this, I feel like she gets to stretch some of that with her just outrageousness and show that she can play too.
Why are you being so nice to me? Can't just be because I remind you of some sad Bulgarian clown.
You remind me of my mother.
Oh, really? You know that. I mean, you and I are pretty close in age.
You're funny. It's the Bulgarian clown in you.
Okay.
She was marvelous, but she was different. Eccentric, like you are.
No.
The moment I saw you standing there in that abortion of a dress,
come on.
It's as if to say, this is what I've got, world. It's hideous, but it's mine. Mm. This was her.
Hey, how'd you get that picture of me? I look amazing. Hello, doppelganger.
She was the only person I could ever trust.
Well, here's to your mom.
To my mother.
I agree. She was so fun. And I've always liked her since Get Him to the Greek. I thought she was really funny in that.
Okay.
And then I liked her Bridesmaids. But in this, I agree. She is such a fun antagonist. And she's so horribly insulting that it's just art. You know, when she and Melissa McCarthy, and I loved when you're talking, you know, when she earns her badassery, mm-hmm. right? There's different stages. She has her first makeover, then she has her sort of second makeover when she cuts her hair. But then in between there, when she gets caught out by being a spy, she just embraces it and she starts just cutting into Rose Byrne's character, and Rose Byrne just cuts into her, and it is so fun to see them trade insults. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that I really liked about this movie is that Melissa McCarthy's character gets people insult her to her face. Allison Janney does, and at the beginning, you know, she calls her, you know, with her pink eye, and mm-hmm. at the beginning she sort of takes it in, and you see her sort of, you know, she sort of absorbs the blows. But by the middle, with Jason Statham's character and Rose Byrne, she fights back, and it's glorious, you know. And she also doesn't get fazed. She doesn't take it personally. She's just, I mean, Jason Statham says horrible things to her, like, you look like a flautist at a wedding. I think
so rude.
That's a great line. And she just is not going to be like feeling like bad about herself. She's like, let me tell you what you look like, idiot. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really fun sort of character arc where she's like, you can say whatever you want to me. I know I can dish it back out.
And she sort of has bigger fish to fry. And it's sort but she's so strategic, right? I was trying to explain to our mother earlier how it really is, I don't watch a lot of spy movies, so tell me where I'm wrong, but a somewhat complex, you know, or complex as they come, spy movie. It just happens to also be a send up to that genre. I mean, it's sort of a farce and a love letter mm-hmm. at the same time, but while also telling a sort of true spy. I mean, in the way that, you know, there's of course a bomb that's going to explode in 7 seconds and nuclear war. I mean, it's tropey.
Right. But I think it works because the Melissa McCarthy character is so winning, because at every moment that you feel she has earned her, she's a total badass. It sort of subverts that, because I remember that great scene where she's on the moped and she's doing a chase, you know, through the streets of, I don't remember if they were in Rome or Hungary at that point. And then she gets caught in the concrete, you know? And so this wonderful moment of like, I am Jason Bourne. I am flying through the air. And I feel like that's something we can all relate to. We've all had those moments where we're like, we are the shit. I feel so great about myself. And then, you know, something happens. And you're like, okay,
back to reality.
I'm stuck in concrete. I'm still awesome, but I'm stuck in concrete. So I thought I loved that about, and I thought that's what grounded so much of that crazy spy, the antics, you know, the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. I thought I could just watch this character forever.
She has to put up with so much more than any of the traditional male spy figures because because, as you say, that the funny parts come from as it comes back to reality. And to circle back, Avery, to something you were saying, it's when I was a little worried when the second makeover happens and she comes out with the dress and the guys are catcalling her from the car, and whereas previously the same guys had been driven by her, not said anything. That they were going to wrap her competence up in a makeover. And I was a little worried, like, please don't. And then the fact that as with the moped or the scooter in the concrete, that grounds to a halt too pretty quickly. And she has to like go to her ingenuity and go to her, you know, as you say, find her sort of strength and fight back, you know, verbally with Rose Byrne. And it's so satisfying to me when she does that. This is, I think, maybe one of the most satisfying moments in the movie to me, because it really feels like she's clicked into who she is in that moment. Like,
yes.
You know, her potential is being tapped, and that's fun to see in any movie, but to see this character who I've grown to become very fond of. I think that her character, another thing that's kind of different from some of the other characters that she has played, is that she's not the grotesque
in the
movie that she does that really well. I don't mean that as a pejorative. It's she's able to, if you look at Bridesmaids, she's going all in on this character, mm-hmm. and like, mm-hmm. you know, but she has to play other notes, a lot of other notes in this way. And it's really fun to see her. I know some people feel like she kind of just does one thing, and I think they probably haven't seen this movie and they're making some judgments based on maybe the SNL that they saw, Aislinn, that you're talking about, or just seeing Bridesmaids, or you know, like that, or Tammy or something. They're missing some other shades of what she's able to do, and I think she's able to show that really well in this movie.
I completely agree, and I think that because a lot of people do know I never saw Gilmore Girls. I was never. I know that's horrendous.
That's, no,
people
that's okay.
love it, but I didn't know her from that. But that whole sort of sassy woman, you know, people really know her. She shows so much heart in this, and the character has so much heart. But Tobin, I had the same, when they had the makeover sequence right in the middle of the film, I groaned when I first saw it. I thought, oh no, not a makeover. Yeah. In fact, two makeover sequences. And that and the catcalling part that you just talked about, those are the only sour notes for me in the film. And it's just because, I don't know. First of all, the one note that I just can't stand is when she comes out in the guy's cat collar and she's just like flattered by it.
Yeah, no, I don't have time for that.
No way. Drive by cat calling. I don't care what you look like, whether you're, it's awful. And I think that, that felt like a wrong comedic note to me also, because it just felt like this woman would, at this point, she would just flip them off.
Right.
You know, she wouldn't give a shit what these guys say about her. Yeah.
And it's too easy. It feels an easy joke, not earned at all.
So then where do we put Aldo and his blatant harassment in terms of how that hit you comedically?
It's a great question. And this is where my students and I came to this idea that we don't know. Once you get to the end of the movie, and we don't know how much of this is an act on his part. But with that aside, this is the... he is acting probably to her the way James Bond acts towards women. It's like, it's less Bradley Fine. It's more Aldo and his like gropey, you know, like it's just sort of gross and slobbery, but he seems to be just completely full of self-confidence in it. You know what I mean? Like he has no idea. It seems that he's as gross as he is, but we are seeing it for the sort of, for being really, really disgusting. And it's a really fine line. I'm not sure. I don't always feel good that I find him so fun to watch. But there's something I think in the fact that she's looking at him like, you are disgusting.
Right. Yes. She's not thinking, oh, he's validating me. She thinks you're disgusting.
And you're in my way.
I also like that he, she's got bigger fish to fry, as I think you put it, you know, before. Also, there's something nice, and it's funny. I really like the Aldo character too. But for him, I feel like he's a character who, whether he's play acting the Italian or he's not, he genuinely thinks she's a great spy, a great agent by the end. And I think he's very, I mean, I choose to think that he's actually attracted to her, mm-hmm. and that he you know, is being disgusting and groupy. And I think that's really funny. He is like the James Bond in his own mind. But it for him, he just sees this gorgeous woman, you know, and he wants to do what a man wants to do. And I think it's just a funny take on that. So I think his character is, I hate to say sweet, but in a way, he's coming from a place of, you know, admiration, although horribly, horribly misogynistic and misplaced. But she's so able to take it that it's fun to watch, you know, because she pushes back so hard.
Aizen, what do you think about Aldo?
Well, you know, I am the fun sucker. And I totally get what you're saying, Avery. And I agree kind of on one path. But then on the other path... Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sort of intent versus impact a little bit of like, if you don't sit in either your class or Tobin's class and dissect and figure out the point of view of him as a Bond and that kind of thing, he's just harassing women throughout the movie for comedic effect.
That I think is true. And I'll say this, that I didn't think, I want to just go back to one thing. And if you guys could like fix that in post, I don't think it's great that I don't think it works because she pushes back. It's not like the onus is on her to make his character work because she fights back. That's, you know, he's icky. But, one thing I think the movie does well, and this is, and I struggled with this too, but one thing I think it does well is that it punches up really well. Mm. It doesn't punch down. Right. So it punches up because it pokes holes in these hyper-masculine tropes. So it's fun to see because the movie is so obviously portraying Aldo and his ilk and, you know, Jason Statham's character as sleazy and kind of out of reality and that I think it's a really fun way to punch up. And I'm glad that the movie's not punching down and making her the butt of the joke. So that I feel like they do well, which is maybe why but you're right. He is gropey and grabby and sexually harassing women. And in the scene at the end when they're tied up together, it's implied that he leaves wetness on her neck, which is not fun for anyone.
That was too far for me of it. And maybe that's just because it was – because that – and then they like, oh, wait, I'm English, not Italian. Oh, but am I like – both of those notes just didn't that lost the charm for me. And maybe because those are the last two times you saw him, that's why I am a little bit more critical. I certainly laughed many times when he was on screen. Because this is, right. You know, because we're in a satirical world, but also, you know, if Joe No Nuance is sitting next to me, he's just seeing this guy, you know.
Do you not think that Joe No Nuance would get that this movie is ridiculing this type of guy?
I think he would get. I mean, Joe No Nuance. I think Joe would get the Jason Statham bit more than this. But that's just
I'll agree that at the end when he's British, is he not? That made me like Aldo, of course, much less because all of a sudden he just, I don't know, then I'm like, oh, so he knows what he was doing the whole time. Whereas before I thought, oh, he's just, you know, Italian and full of amore, which is still no excuse.
No, but an explanation. Yeah.
Tobin, what did you, did the movie hit any like notes for you that you, other than the catcalling or the makeover part, how did you feel about Aldo?
Yeah. For me, the movie seems to view him as gross, and I think that I would hate to. I'm leery of sanding down some of his in the name of, I don't know, being. I'm leery of like taking out. I do find it effective when they're struggling with the ropes and stuff, and he claims to have had this sort of sexual experience with on her. I feel a little guilty always for laughing at Aldo, but I do find that I think they're playing him as gross. The character that I love I always forget is in the movie is the guy who's, I don't know if he's meant to be Swedish or what, but he's Rose Byrne's security guy who shows up and the first thing that happens to him is, yes, yes, and Melissa McCarthy hits him in the head with her phone and knocks him down and just beats the shit out of him through every scene they're in together until he gets just mowed down by a machine gun. Like it takes another one of these tropes of this spy movie, which is like the Nordic sort of assassin protector, you know, bodyguard guy. And just like, oh, she makes him weep. And then he just gets mowed down. I mean, it takes the air out of that in a way that maybe buys some of Aldo for me,
yeah.
You know, like that the fact that so often it's Melissa McCarthy, who at this point in the movie is like fully in charge right. of who she is. And I find their scenes really, really fun.
I feel like that was sort of an initiation moment for her, because now she's okay. I'm your bodyguard. So in order to accomplish that, she's got to sort of dismantle the ego of the existing bodyguard in order to. Yeah.
But see, and I think that she, this is the way I read the scene, which I think is an interesting sort of point in her character development. I think she just didn't like his face. I think she just thought this guy, like, we don't even get to know him. Like he says two lines and she just starts insulting his appearance, which is what people right. have been doing to her the whole movie.
Right.
Which again, right. good, bad, I don't know, but she certainly just does not let him. I mean, she just makes up her mind based on 2 seconds of him speaking and the way he looks. And she calls him what, a bag of dicks. So I actually like that. I feel like she's sort of crossing over too. And her part of her badassery is that, yeah, she's going to be a little bit of a dick sometimes, you know, and that's okay.
So you're both named Amber.
Whoa. What did I tell you about talking to me?
Nothing. You just said nothing about talking.
You know what? You want me to have Cagney and fucking Lacey explain it to you? Cagney's coming down your fucking throat. Lacey, she's going to come up your ass. I'm going to meet him in the fucking middle and play your heart like a fucking accordion. I'm going to pump that shit until it pops, you Swedish bitch.
You wouldn't dare.
You going to cry, you little Swiss fucking pussy?
I'm not going to cry.
You're crying now.
I'm not. It's so fucking hot.
One fun thing about that actor, Bjorn Gustafsson, he plays Dwight in the Swedish version of The Office.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, he's got that face, you know, that face that you want to punch.
Yes. Yeah, you can see it. You can see it. Yeah.
You know, it's funny though, about comedy in general, because my husband and I still do, we still do improv here down in Savannah with a great group of people. And sometimes we'll do scenes that are wildly inappropriate and just like, I just hope, you know, luckily we don't allow cameras, you know, like in our live shows, because, you know, stuff happens. Sometimes you push the boundaries of comedy and we're trying to explore certain ideas. So it's hard because I'm a feminist, but I also will go places sometimes in my comedy that are not politically correct. And sometimes I think that's important to explore these ideas. So it's such mm-hmm. a fine line that I feel like I'm always walking, but sometimes to do comedy for me, that's where I can make my peace with the Aldo character, because he's yucky and disgusting and awful. But if we're satirizing that character, you got to go bold. And so, yeah, I think it's, even though it's a yucky moment for me, him being that gross and making her neck wet is at the end, is crossing that line, but it's effective, you know, for better or for worse. Well, it's effective. So I think for the better, I guess, is what
I'm
saying. Sure.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think earlier in the film and in other places, I would agree much more. And I don't want to be the captain of appropriateness. So for example, you know, I mean, Broad City is one of my favorite shows, not appropriate, right? In any way. and makes bold choices and has yucky characters. I mean, there's, you know, I think there's all kinds of ways to do that. I just, for me in the place I am now, that was, was assault.
Yeah.
Once you deflate that balloon for me is really, really hard to blow it back up. So that's what I think.
Yeah, sure.
And for me, you know, it's a good point. And for me, it's funny, the catcalling, the drive-by catcalling was the point that sort of was my line of being crossed, but the sexual assault part is actually much worse. So it's interesting. Toby, did you have a moment in the movie that just lost you for that?
Yeah, but it's the mid-credit scene, which maybe we'll get to when we get to the end, or maybe we'll just talk about it now, where ends up.
I may not have. Remind me what it is.
Okay, so the movie ends, and then there's first set of credits, and then it's a bedroom, and it's early morning, and she wakes up in bed next to Jason Statham.
Oh yeah.
And they don't even have good. There's not like a good joke or anything. Like that's the joke.
He just says, "Oh, you loved it," or whatever.
Yeah, and like that's so sour to me. When I watch this movie on my own, I turn it off before that scene happens because I don't
want her to end up. If she's gonna have a wild night, have it be with someone who understands the difference between a lake and the ocean.
Right, exactly.
I'm also
for getting hers. I think.
Yeah, exactly. To be fair, my problem is my problem is not that she is having sex with somebody.
No, of course not. Yes,
the movie is ending with like this is her prize.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think when I think now that you're reminding me, it was the end of the movie later in the evening. I think in my head, I just assumed that he got really drunk and fell asleep and assumes that something happened. Now, I know that's not what they intended.
Oh, wow.
But that's what I decided was that he thinks he was great.
That is a retcon, and I'm going to pretend that you're right.
Okay, thank you. The other, while we're right there with Jason Statham, though, I think the moment for me that just sort of crystallized they're all think they're Bond and whatever else, was him jumping onto her on the helicopter and saying, I'm saving
you. Right.
Yes, yes, yes.
That was just like, okay, that is what all of this is. But just right there in that perfect visual and one line, I'm saving you.
It's such a great example of this distillation of this male, I'm going to come in and save the world. But also right before that, before she goes to the final, I guess we're jumping to the third act, but I love the line where, maybe it's a little over the top, but I actually really loved it where he says, how do you know? She says, I'm going to the villa. And he says, how do you know where it is? And she says, I know everything. And I know that's over the top and maybe on the nose, but I just like internally cheered. I just think, she's a total, she completely embraces how great she is. So, and has earned it. So I actually really like that.
And that's another line that you could put in a traditional male protagonist spy movie and not play for laughs and would be perfectly at home. Like we would buy that in that movie. And it's in this refracted through her. You're like, oh, wow. But it's comedy now. Why is it comedy? Oh, because it's true here.
Right, like, right.
And there we kind of take it for granted as a trope of the genre, not as something that's sort of often, not as something that's necessarily been earned.
Well, also, I like speaking of like things that are earned at the end, I love that Miranda Hart's character, she's kind of the one woman who is not quite as like all the women. Even the assassins and Allison Janney, they're all really good at what they do, right? And Miranda Hart, she's good at what she does, but she feels she's definitely the sidekick, right? She's scared. She's out of shape. She can't, it's really, really funny. But at the end, I love that 50 Cent is in love with her and that she's really good at shooting. She's like, I'm really good at this. It's such a fun, empowering movie in the end for me.
I hadn't remembered the 50 Cent part. And so when I was watching it, I thought, oh, wait, am I watching like a director's cut? Because I did not remember that little thread from the theatrical version. So I don't know why I erased that love story for the ages in my mind. But
maybe he doesn't love her. I read too much.
Well, he's infatuated with her.
Which I think serves the movie beautifully. I don't know that it needs to be, a love for all time.
Right. And actually, now that we're thinking about it, she sort of assaulted him and jumped on him and tried to kiss him. So it's an interesting, it certainly did not ejaculate on his neck. So it's there's no equivalency there
that we know of.
maybe that part is in the director's cut.
Oh my goodness!
Now that we're just talking about the women, I had a question of what you guys thought about. Do you think I thought it was interesting that all the women who are villains sort of looked a certain way? And again, I think it's an example of sort of them punching up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not punching down. So I thought that was. And they all kind of looked the same, sleek and high heels and all that kind of stuff.
This brings me to one story I did want to get to, which involves Rose Byrne and her look, which is her hair, which is amazing. And there's a story that Paul Feig tells on the director's commentary where he says that. So Rose Byrne and the hairstylist wanted to come up with it. They were walking around Budapest where they were going to shoot this movie, and they were seeing all this great hair, these blowouts, these big sort of dudes, and they wanted to do something. So they went for a couple hours into the wig trailer and came out with this look. And everybody thought it was, I mean, even Paul Feig thought, oh, I don't know. This looks like a little much. And the studio was saying, I don't know. This looks like, I'm not sure this is, maybe we could bring it back a little bit. And so he went back to her and said, I'm sorry. I feel like maybe it's just a little over the top. And he says her face just fell in that moment. And I love the story because it sort of, you can see this, I can see Rose Byrne having this reaction. And he said, I decided, fuck it. She gets to have the hair she wants. She said, here's the only thing I want to say is that we're going to make fun of it all through the movie. Right. And she's like, that's fine. Because he says in the commentary, she found the character through the hair. Like he could tell that she had, when she did her hair this way, it was like she knew exactly who this character was. And you can see that kind of from that, the physicality of she doesn't always open her eyes all the way, you know, like her lids are sort of, she's heavy lidded and sardonic and almost like she's moving underwater half the time and not really effective at what she's doing in kind of funny ways. And yet also like a cutthroat, you know, villain. So anyway, I just thought that said a lot, I think, about both Rose Byrne and Paul Feig, that's sort of where they met in the middle on the look for her.
Oh, I love that story. I didn't know that. And because her hair is such a part of the character. Yeah. And you're right. It's like the hair weighs her down. She's just so exhausted all the time, you know, from carrying on that hair. And they do, they have so many fun jokes about the hair. So that's awesome.
I think this movie looks absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
I think both from a shot construction point of view, the way he's moving the camera to sort of ape a lot of the maybe that's not the way I say that. The way he's moving the camera to echo the tropes of the genre, and then just the production design of the movie. I mean, it just looks beautiful. This is the first movie that to geek out on this just a little bit. This is the first Paul Feig movie that was shot digitally instead of being shot on film. And and one which surprised me by the look of it. And one of the things that they apparently did was they added a little bit of smoke to a lot of the scenes, just to take, because digital cinematography is often very, very crisp, sometimes to the sort of detriment of your actors things can look just too sharp. And so they added just a little bit of smoke. They found doing that in a lot of the scenes gave it a little bit more diffuse texture. And I think they pulled off something beautiful, because I couldn't, and often I can't tell. I'm not like one of these people who can, or is turning my nose up at digital cinematography. But I thought it was cool. They found a way to make this spy movie feel still kind of James Bondy in the best sense, you know? So anyway, that was my,
beautiful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a beautiful movie.
Didn't they shoot the whole thing in Hungary because it could look like Rome and Paris, or did they actually shoot it in Rome and Paris? Do you know?
Almost everything was shot in Hungary, and then they would shoot. So there's like a scene where Susan Cooper is in the a cab. She's come to Paris, and she's in a cab driving through Paris, and they pass these grand hotels and pass the Eiffel Tower and then pass worse and worse parts of town until they get to the hotel that has a rat crawling across the sign. All the exterior shots, the shots from her point of view of the city were shot in Paris, but then her in the cab is in Hungary, right? So they shot these sort of incidental things in other cities, but you're right, almost everything else was shot in Hungary.
It looks, you're right, the movie looks absolutely gorgeous, and the interiors, and where is that final scene where I don't know where it is. It's probably in the third act where I know Melissa McCarthy's character calls Rose Byrne doesn't she make fun of her scuba outfit or something like that?
And yes.
It looks like this amazing interior. I don't know where it is, but it's just, I thought, my goodness, where do they find that? Somewhere in Budapest,
yeah.
I assume.
He talks about finding a lot of locations that were sort of former like communist estates back when you know Hungary was a communist. So like there's the opening party scene that where Jude Law is going through this party and she's talking in his ear. That was apparently one of like it was Castro's like vacation home when he would come visit Hungary. Yeah, like there's lots of places like that, these villas there that that were sort of you know, for high flying communists from around the world who would come to vacation in Hungary.
And, you know, I know we're going to go over the game, but just speaking of just let me geek out for 1 second about that opening scene in that party scene that you were talking about, where Jude Law does his, you know, we first meet him. I love those first 5 minutes because we're in James Bond world, right? Mm-hmm. He is looking the part, he's doing all of that. And then he sneezes. The guy, and they've set up in like three lines and he's the only guy who knows where the nuclear bomb is. And he shoots the guy through the head, you know, gets upset about it. And then we meet Melissa McCarthy who through his ear. And I thought that is such a fantastic setup of the tone,
yeah.
The comedy, the characters. It's just
totally
brilliant.
So economical. Yeah. It's so smart. It's, and it does not give away whether the movie's even a comedy until that moment. And it's,
But then at that point, you know what to expect moving forward.
Right.
Yeah. That's awesome. The fight scenes too, while you're talking about how beautiful it was to look at, and that I thought I wrote down sort of immediately that were to me as choreographed, I mean that in a good way.
Oh, yeah.
As a like legitimate in quotes action movie. I mean they spent the time and the money mm-hmm. on things to make it, you know, like sort of like the straight lace version would be, except that in this one, he sneezes and shoots the only guy who can help.
And that scene in the kitchen, I do not like action. Like fight sequences, I could fast forward through. Like, especially if they're too quickly cut.
Yeah.
I can't understand who's hitting whom. Like, it drives me crazy. Yeah. But I love that kitchen fight scene with the female assassin. It's so funny. It's got a sense of humor. It's fun. They're equal. It's just, I could watch that. I've actually like rewound and watched that again and again. It's such a well done choreographed scene.
All right. Do you want to play a game?
Yes, let's play a game. Yes.
Okay.
Yay.
So this game is called Oh, the Humanity. So as I believe I mentioned in my opening comments, what really stuck with me, and if you know me, this has layers, from the whole thing was Melissa McCarthy stabbing the guy and then vomiting on him. Because that's the first time she's really been like, I mean, hand-to-hand combat that wasn't staged for training,
right?
far as we know.
Right.
And that was such a human reaction versus a super spy mm-hmm. reaction to mm-hmm. things.
Right.
So you are both accomplished writers and humans. And neither of you are spies that I know of. So I'm going to give you a scenario from sort of an action sequence from a well-known film. And I would like you to rewrite a character's reaction to it. whether it would be your reaction or a, you know, first-time spy out there sort of. Would you please add the humanity back into some of these things?
Oh, I love this game. Okay, great.
So my next question is, would you like to each do a couple of your own, or would you like me to give you one and then you both give me an answer?
I'd rather you give me one, just since I don't know action sequences quite as well.
Okay. So here's one that I hope will be familiar. In the Hunger Games series, mm-hmm. either book or film, but film for our purposes, the games begin with all the tributes around a cornucopia of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And they all, right? And then you all, the timer goes, and then you all have to run in, grab what you want, and people start killing each other immediately.
Mm-hmm.
What would a bumbling tribute with the humanity of a Melissa McCarthy, how would they react to that situation versus how, you know, Jennifer Lawrence character did, or add the humanity to Jennifer Lawrence character, however you want to conceptualize?
Hmm.
Well, I think first of all, I'm just going to think if it were me there.
Perfect.
I would definitely be like the last person to the table to get the weapon, and I'd probably trip. And I always feel bad when I see those reality shows. I love seeing like the baking reality shows. I watch them with my daughter all the time. And I always feel bad for that, like that older woman in the back who's like, just can't run as fast as the mm-hmm. yeah. And they're always the last person to end up with like the, you know, the I don't know, the cumin powder as opposed to like chocolate, you know, that would be me. Like I would be stuck with nothing. And so I'd trip, I would definitely fall. So how would I do? What would I do? I probably, if I didn't die, then I would probably try to find the person who looked as scared as I did and just say, I will protect you as much as I can. Please. Can I join you? So that would probably cry. I'd probably add a lot of crying. And I would find somebody who looked scared, so they looked as vulnerable as I did. And then I would, and then if they said, no, you're on your own, I would say, I will block you with my body. And then I don't know if I would or not, but I would probably, you know that I cheat.
I love it. It's true.
I have horrible cheater in game, so I probably would lie at that point. Yeah.
I love trip and then make a friend and then double cross them. That is.
Yes.
Oh, the humanity indeed.
Oh my God. That's good.
Tobin, would you like a different one?
Yeah, give me a different one. Yeah, because I think that's you can't best that. That's great. That's great.
That's true. Okay. It was sort of highly anticipated, I'm going to say, from Ghost Protocol, when Tom Cruise had the sticky gloves.
Uh-huh.
The Tom Cruise character, and had to go outside the skyscraper.
Yes. Yes, in Dubai or wherever.
Right. Yeah. So please add some humanity to that scenario for me.
Okay, this is easy.
I would fall down.
Yes, exactly.
Just slide down.
I would be so I'd be so terrified of the heights to begin with that I would get out there with my sticky gloves, take one look over my shoulder, shit my pants, and just freeze. I just freeze. You couldn't get me off. You couldn't do anything. I would never move again.
And then the window washers would come by in a couple weeks.
They would have to peel me off and bring me back in. And it's
even if you were inside the window saying, come on, just come back in.
No,
you
would be I couldn't. That high? No, fuck no. I'm stuck to that window. I'm a bug on that windshield at that point.
And then Jason Statham is going to climb you, you know, and try
Yes. Jump out and grab me and say he's going to save me. Yes, exactly. Oh, God.
That's excellent. All right. For this last one, I would like you both to participate because it is all about family.
Mm.
So we recently guested on the Too Fast, Too Forever podcast for the first episode of the second lap, where we talked about the first in the series, The Fast and the Furious. And so the climactic scene there is a truck jacking gone wrong. And there's team members driving cars. There are people driving cars from positions that are not the driver's seat. There's someone stuck by a cable to the side of a semi. And I believe jumping from car to car, which is all pretty low stakes if you take into account where this franchise goes. But this was the climactic moment of this. So what would you do in this carjacking gone wrong scenario if you were on the Toretto team?
So to get the car, get the truck back in control, what would I do?
Or to if you were in that, you're in a car and suddenly you're in the middle of a carjacking.
Okay.
And all these things I described are going on around you.
Okay.
How would you be part of that situation?
Okay. So I'm thinking of my minivan because that's what I'm putting myself
in situation. Mm-hmm. Please. Yep.
And I have sunscreen and 100 the bug spray.
Yeah.
Because we're in the South in Savannah and there are mosquitoes and gnats. And so we always have to have the 100, and it's like the hardcore.
Yeah.
When Maddie was like first born, we were like, oh, organic. We're just going to have non-talk now. We both get eaten. So it's like 100% DEET. So I would spray. I would try to gain, because I don't actually know the scene that well. So I'm just going to say that I would, if someone tried to carjack or get my car, I would spray them in the eyes with sunscreen and follow it up with a good dose of 100% DEET spray.
Wow.
Right. And then I think I would be able to just, I would just try to take the car back over that way.
I think that's great.
That's really good.
Tobin, what did you, there's room for everyone here. How would you be a part of it?
I drive a Prius, which will not go fast enough to keep up with any of those cars. So the first answer is that they'd all just blast past me and I'd still be puttering along, but getting excellent gas mileage. But the other
possibility. And saving the world.
Yes, and saving the world. Yes, exactly. But when I am in sort of more tense driving situations, I spent a few years driving back and forth from Brooklyn to New Jersey to teach at a college out there. And there were times, especially in the Jersey portion of that drive, when things would get a little tense sometimes. People drove in some crazy ways in New Jersey. And I tend to get have a very dirty mouth when I'm driving in sort of tense situations. And so I would be cursing a blue streak and white knuckling the steering wheel and then trying to keep my body as sort of loose as possible so that when I crashed, I wouldn't inadvertently break bones that I didn't need to. I would just be sort of flop around the car as it sort of rolled and spun. So it would be more for me about sort of saving myself than doing anything for the team.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So cursing a blue streak, white knuckling it, but keeping the body loose in case.
Yes, those would be the three things going through my head at that scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you know what. It's a moving car. I would say this, and I would definitely do this. I would try to get in front of all the traffic because what I would do is that if there was like an off ramp and there was a big line to get on the exit ramp, I would try to scoot in front of everyone, and then I'd be that asshole who'd be at the very front, and then I'd wave and smile and make you know, like, please let me in. Thank you. I would totally do that to get away from the bad guy.
I want to see Avery's version of the Fast and the Furious. This sounds amazing.
I do too.
Better than the actual movie.
I have a humanity question. I know that it just this is something that that Dave and I always and I Tobin. I don't know. Maybe this has been like a longstanding thing with me and Dave. So you know the end of Seven.
Yes.
Right. Would you pull the trigger?
Oh yeah.
Or not?
Totally. I would know. Right? I would know that I shouldn't. But in that moment, I would not. I'd blow that guy's fucking head off. Yeah, totally.
You know that Dave and I got in a big fight. My husband and I, we've been married 16 years. He's the most amazing guy in the world. Island, I don't know if you know the story, but we were watching Seven after, you know, we watched it many, many times. And this is years ago. And I said, oh, what a great third act. You know, oh my goodness, I love that Brad Pitt's character has to make an on-camera choice. And, oh, you know, what a dilemma. You know, you pull the trigger and you fulfill his horrible, you know, seven deadly sins master plan, but then you don't avenge your wife or do you avenge your wife's, you know, head. And Dave's like, well, you know, he's already dead. So, I mean, she's already dead. So, like, you'd already be dead. So what he would have done? I'm like, no.
Wrong you answer, Dave. Wrong answer.
I'm still talking about it all these years later. Like, you avenge me, you pull the trigger.
So funny.
What would you do, Island?
I would first admit that while I know everything that you're talking about, have not seen the film.
Yeah.
Oh, did I just spoil?
I know what's in the box. I know the seven deadly sins, the whole thing. It fulfills his sort of prophecy about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know the stakes in the moment. Were he assured to be captured? Like if I knew for sure.
He's handcuffed and on his knees, and it's just you and Morgan Freeman and Kevin's book. And if we say Kevin Spacey, that might balance these days. And the villain on his knees, handcuffed in the desert, and you have the gun. Like there's no.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
Kevin Spacey, who we would shoot anyway at this point, but Kevin Spacey, his character, cut off the head of.
Yes.
Your, yes. Let's just say your dog. Let's just say it.
Okay. Well, that is.
Oh, yes. That's the question. You found it.
I mean, those are the stakes. Yeah, steak. Yeah. Would you avenge your dog and pull the trigger and kill Kevin Spacey?
I would avenge my dog by, making sure that, the trial goes in my favor.
Oh my God, you and Dave are like the best people I know. Toby
and then he would have to.
Yes, we are. And I think we're all and honest, I like to say. I think not that you're not being honest, Asim, but I think we're also honest in our vengeance. Yeah. I'd empty the clip into that motherfucker.
My vengeance is just different.
David says he still stands by it. You and Dave are good people who have who do not make emotional decisions. Clearly,
I wish
don't make decisions from emotional places. Like, but if he what has, I do all the time.
Yeah. Well, but I don't know. It's a tough one, and maybe I'll think on it. I have not been asked that before, so
please don't. What a horrible scenario I just put in your head.
But in the meantime, we have another important question. Tobin, what's our final question?
Yes, so now is the point in our podcast where we decide if this movie is progressive or regressive. Is this a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? What are your closing thoughts on Spy, Avery?
Ooh, yeah. I'm going to – I'll tell you, Aislinn, you brought up some good points about Creepy Aldo. On balance, I would say it's progressive. I think it shows a woman who finds her badassery and she's full of humanity, and it subverts some of the tropes that we've come to expect, all the while highlighting the role that women sometimes play as support roles in these, and it shines a light on that. So I think it's ultimately progressive.
Awesome. Aislinn, what about you?
Yeah, I agree 100% with Avery. I think both in looking at the performances themselves, like we talked about Rose Byrne, with that the hair story that she had, as well as Allison Janney, just such standout I think performances for some really amazing actors. And then just as Avery said, sort of highlighting and thumbing your nose at not only what is expected, but what is really true to life that we all deal with while we're not all spies that we know of. I think we've all dealt with some element of that sort of workplace gender shuffle. So I would say yes, on balance, progressive. Tobin?
I agree with everything you've both said. To take another tack on this, for a smart female led spy movie to gross $250 million is absolutely a thing that we need now and needed in 2015 and need more of. So I vote progressive as well.
You're here. I like that. Yes.
Well, to change pace entirely, next up, we've got Waitress. One of my favorites, she says out of the corner of her mouth. Coming up in two weeks. I don't know if I should show my hand already, but I have not looked at it with this particular lens. But Waitress coming up in 2 weeks on September 4th. So watch Waitress for the first time or for the 100th time, as I'll be doing, and join us then.
Yeah, and this is not a movie I've ever seen, so I am...
And I've been asking Tobin to watch it for years, so I pretty much agreed to do a podcast to get him to watch this movie.
It's such a good movie. Yes, it's awesome. And I haven't seen it in years, but I will listen in on your podcast and hear you guys break it down.
Awesome.
Have you ever had a movie that you thought was purely, I'm just curious, regressive?
Yes.
Ooh, really? Which one?
Well, we watched Twilight.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then there was one that I said regressive, and Tobin said progressive, Tobin said regressive, and I put it just on the line, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say regressive, and then Tobin did. It was a whole thing. You'll have to listen to that episode.
I will. It's my goodness. I can't wait to hear it.
Avery, thank you so much for joining us. It was so much fun to talk to you as always, but to hear your thoughts on Spy. Do you want to be found online? And if so, where can people find you? Or is there something you'd like to plug? Is there a comedy show people can come see you in? Is there an improv show or something coming up?
Oh, that's actually good. Because I was like, I actually have nothing to plug. And nothing. I'm really not online. I mean, I don't really have a social media presence. And I haven't been on Facebook in a few years.
Good
so
for you.
I got to work on that.
No. You're doing it right. You're doing it right. That's why we say it this way.
But actually in Savannah, if you find yourself in Savannah, come see Front Porch Improv. And we perform every Saturday night. It's really fun. You can see me doing inappropriate thing. No.
Sometimes
inappropriate things on stage.
I'll be in the front row, Avery.
This has been so much fun, you guys. Thank you. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Well, I hope you'll come back and do another movie in the future as we continue to do these. This is a lot of fun.
I would love to. You guys are awesome.
You can find me on Twitter, although I'm trying to take a break, but you can still sometimes find me there. I'm at Tobin Addington.
And I am much more successful at taking a break. I am at SassyNerdMT on Twitter. And you can find us at facebook.com/thecontenderspod or on Twitter @contenders_pod. Come say hi. We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. I am currently wearing my Cage Club t-shirt.
Oh, good job.
Thank you. You can explore all their great shows at cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And you can find them on Twitter @CageClubPod.
If you like our show, or if you don't like our show, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. That makes us feel good, helps us spread the word about the show. We really appreciate you listening. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Avery Stork.
I'm Aislinn Addington. And we'll see you next time on The Contenders. And Jeno Topping. Don't know if I said that name right. Sorry, I stepped on your ding.
No, that's okay, because I can take out your line and just leave the ding.
Love it.
Yeah.